I'm going to begin, I suppose, completely unsurprisingly, with the Gaza war. As you will see in the media, this is the 6 month anniversary of the events in October, when Hamas and other fighters broke out of what is in effect an open prison. I'm not going to comment on the specific events on October the 7th, except to say or to reiterate, really, my take on the Al Jazeera documentary, which I think is a pretty good stab at, at journalism. At its best, the first draft of history, as compared with the run-of-the-mill Zionist propaganda that we've been getting from BBC, ITV, Sky, let alone CNN and all the rest of it in the United States. But of course, also what we've had. And I don't know how to react emotionally to this, but the killing of seven aid workers, workers for the World Central Kitchen. We all know the story of a drone strike on one of the cars. People clamber out of that car into a second car, that gets struck into a third car. And we're left with seven dead. And as a result of that, we've had various politicians, not least the UK's Prime Minister Rishi Sunak, getting onto the phone to Benjamin Netanyahu in Jerusalem to express, I quote, how appalled he is by this action. Well, I agree. I agree with Rishi Sunak. I'm appalled by this action. The problem is that thus far, before these six, because do we count the Palestinian? Does that one count? We have three from the UK, one from Canada, one from Poland. These are the ones that get Rishi Sunak expressing how appalled he is. Well, so far, my understanding is, in terms of known deaths, we're talking about 33,000 deaths of Palestinians since October the 7th. And I think that death toll includes 196 aid workers. So why is it the World Central Kitchen? The death, appalling death, absolutely right. The appalling death of these six aid workers. Why has that provoked the British Prime Minister to get onto the phone to Netanyahu when nothing so far seems to have caused him outrage? We've had the same, of course, from Joe Biden. This is appalling. And we've also had what I can only regard as crocodile tears from Joe Biden about the prospect of starvation in Gaza. My understanding is that something like a third of the population now stand on the threshold of starvation. And of course, what that means, as has been explained in the Weekly Worker and other papers, isn't that people are going to die from hunger, die from lack of food? The usual course of events is that lack of food, lack of nutrition makes you vulnerable to everyday diseases, diarrhea, a common cold. But of course, what's happening at the same time as we're getting these expressions of concern for the population of Gaza, this expressions of how appalled people are about the killing of these aid workers, we're getting delivery of arms. Now, when it comes to Britain, The amount of arms we're talking about, or is inconsequential. What matters in terms of Britain is the symbolism of Britain supplying arms to Israel. But of course, it's the reality of US arms, £2,000 bunker buster bombs, £500 bombs, 27 additional F-35 fighters. Oh, we're told that these contracts were entered into years ago, and I'm sure that's right, but the US president has the power to put a stop to such deliveries, because the conditions that I've just described, where not only 33,000 people have died, but something like, what, 500,000, 3/4 of a million people stand on the edge of starvation. That amounts to genocide. And Israel, of course, blames, believe it or not, the UN and aid agency and Hamas for this situation. The reality is that from the beginning, Israel, with the approval of, for example, Keir Starmer, the leader of the British Labour Party, cut off water, cut off medicines, cut off food supplies, cut off medical supplies, ordered the population to evacuate Gaza City. So we now have, what, 1.5 million people crammed in to the very bottom of the Gaza Strip. Where the International Court of Justice talked about the possibility of genocide, we're now entering the reality of genocide. And I would have thought, unless the Gaza Strip is flooded, not only with food and clean water and medicines, but also with the medics that can actually deliver that, what we would be talking about within the coming weeks, certainly in the coming months, isn't 33,000 deaths, but something of the order of 330,000 deaths. So, in terms of this 6 month anniversary, we see nothing to celebrate. It's true that the Hamas fighters showed a certain heroism, or you could say heroism stroke desperation. I think that would be more accurate. It's certainly true, as shown by the Al Jazeera documentary, that they expected 90% casualties when they were actually attacking military and police posts. They weren't expecting Israel to be completely unprepared. And of course, it wasn't the Israelis, or let alone the Americans, didn't know what was coming. The key question is those at the top of the military, the top of Israeli politics, refused to believe what they were told, that an attack was pending, and that this would be a serious attack. Hamas apparently couldn't do any such thing. So I think that what we're dealing with, actually, when it comes to America, when it comes to Britain, is fear that not only in the court of public opinion, but actually in the International Criminal Court, they are going to be charged, I think quite rightly, with complicity in genocide. Yes, Israel is carrying out a genocide, and those that, knowing that, continue to supply that country with arms and diplomatic cover until very recently in the UN, when the US didn't veto, didn't vote for the resolution, but didn't veto it. This is indeed complicity with genocide. Worth noting the fight back conducted by the right of the Tory party, and I'm taking the right of the Tory party in this particular context to be represented by the former Prime Minister Boris Johnson, who talked in civilizational terms, that apparently to cut off arms to Israel would be treachery to Western civilization. Well, looking at what Israel is doing in Gaza, if this is an example of Western civilization, well, my reply to that is keep your civilization, keep your Western civilization. Meanwhile, I don't know exactly what to make of it, but meanwhile, we have Israel not only fighting a war in the south, okay, a completely uneven, unequal war, but we also have Israel acting in a way that it wants to open up war more generally in the Middle East. We not only get tit for tat exchanges on its northern border between Hezbollah and Israel. We've just had the drone attack on the Iranian consulate in Damascus, which included the killing of a leading Revolutionary Guard general, as well as six other Revolutionary Guard officials. What does Israel want? To promote war, to provoke Iran? We've had a situation of where Israel basically blames the whole situation on Iran. That included the Houthi attacks, that included Hezbollah firing back a rocket. For every rocket Israel fires, it fires a rocket, that sort of carry on. But to take out a diplomatic consulate, where's the international outrage about that? We're told by Israel that, well, there were military people in it. Well, my guess would be in Damascus as we speak, if we went to the Russian embassy or the American embassy, I'd absolutely be gobsmacked to be told that there were no military people visiting those embassies. I would be amazed if that wasn't the case with Turkey and a whole number of other countries. So, of course, there would be a military presence. And I'm not talking about guards. I'm talking about the fact that what we've had in Syria is a civil war with all manner of different players involved. Yes, sometimes indirectly, as in the case of Iran, but also directly in the form of, for example, the United States. Either way, this is an incredibly provocative action. And either this is done to show that Iran is a paper tiger, that it's just full of talk, it doesn't dare act. Well, if it's designed to expose that, the danger is that if you pull the tiger's tail and try to expose it too often to be a paper tiger, it is capable of biting back. And indeed, there will be pressure on Iran internally and also externally for it to do something. Now, what it ends up doing, I haven't got a clue. All I know, or at least all I understand, all I think I know, is Iran does not want a war with Israel. Again, while we're not talking about something being completely uneven, as with Hamas versus Israel in the Gaza Strip, or for that matter, on the West Bank, we are dealing with the regional superpower that's armed with the latest American fighter planes, tanks, drones, you name it, where Iran is in a completely different division. The difference is, of course, that what we're dealing with in Iran is a country with, what, I don't know, 80, 90 million people, a country that no one is talking about invading, but clearly Israel has an interest in bringing the United States back on side. And one way of going about it, yes, is to open up temporarily, remember, these gates in the border between Israel and the Gaza Strip in the north. And it's also withdrawn, I would have thought, again, temporarily, most of its troops in the far south. But at the same time, it seems to be acting in a way to provoke a war with Iran in order to force the United States to come to its rescue, or some other scenario along those lines. And what's all that about? I think it's about Israel's version of the final solution, because we were all expecting before October the 7th to be, the main place where this conflict would be fought out wasn't going to be the Gaza Strip. It was going to be the West Bank, the West Bank, where the Israeli Knesset has passed legislation making way for the annexation of new lands for new settlements. That's where we expected it to be. And we expected that to be covered by Israel exploiting some international incident of one sort or another. So we didn't expect it in Gaza. Nonetheless, we should put the West Bank precisely in that picture. And we should also put the 20% Arab population of Israel proper into that picture, i.e., the drive of Zionism to get rid of its unwanted Arab population, to purify Israel, greater Israel, so it's a Jewish state for Jewish people. And the threat that the Arabs represent in terms of their numbers can be removed. Well, okay, you externalize it. And the problem, of course, is for Israel, is we're not dealing with the same sort of colonial settler type model as we were with Australia, let alone the United States, where there was an endless supply coming in of new migrants, either from the homeland or more generally from Europe, as in the case of the United States. Israel has no such supply of people, something like half Jewish population in the world, something like that, lives in Israel. Are the rest of the world's Jewish population going to go to Israel because that's a safe place for Jews to be? I'm very skeptical. But even if you saw, the Jewish population of New York decamp to Israel, or the Jewish population of North London decamp to Israel, you're still dealing with a situation of where the Palestinians are part of and seen as part of a much wider Arab population. I don't know what the number of Arabs is, but if I said 250 million, it wouldn't be wrong. And that's exactly why Karl Kautsky, in his little booklet on the Jewish question, warned Jewish people about Zionism being a false solution, and warned about the possibility of a super pogrom facing the Jewish people if they followed the Zionists to Israel, because what we're dealing with isn't a small native population. Actually, what we're dealing with is a huge native population, a native population, as I said, of the Middle East, that certainly identifies with the Palestinians. Okay, just very quickly, in Britain, meanwhile, we have a number of councillors resigning from the Labour Party. The latest is a batch of 20, and they cite bullying. I think you'd have to put bullying in the context of Gaza. I think there's no doubt about that. But anyway, we have resignations in Pendle, Nelson, and Brierfield. This is in Lancashire. And that follows the resignation of 11 in Burnley. Is Keir Starmer worried about this? Well, you might see when the general election happens, we presume it's going to be this year, you might see the return of some independence. It's not impossible. I mean, I'm thinking in particular of Jeremy Corbyn, perhaps, if she doesn't have the wit restored to her, Diane Abbott. Obviously, we've got George Galloway in Rochdale, but maybe others. But actually, no, Keir Starmer isn't losing any sleep over that. Why? Because all we need to do is look at the opinion polls, and what they're predicting is a Labour landslide. So the prediction is, what is it, 400 Labour seats, 154 majority. And of course, we need to remember that the Tories not only face a challenge from a rising Labour Party, which is eating in to its electorate from, I call it the left, so forgive me, but also, and don't forgive me for this one, is also eating into the Tory party from the right. And what I'm thinking of here is Reform UK. And if it goes ahead with its threat to stand candidates, the Tory party will be squeezed from both sides and reduced to who knows what. So at the moment, Keir Starmer hasn't got anything to worry about. It's true that he's changed his line on Gaza. I already referred to his support for Israel, cutting off food, water, and other such aid. He's shifted. But why has he shifted? You could put the explanation down to 11 councillors in Burnley, or 20 councillors just more recently. But to me, the explanation is quite simple, and it's called following the United States. It's following the United States and its refusal to use its veto in the UN. It's Joe Biden getting onto the phone to Netanyahu and saying this doesn't look good. But no shift in foreign policy. And I would just say this. When I look at the United States, I think we need to be careful when we think about the possibility of a Trump presidency. I don't think Trump would necessarily represent any radical change compared with Biden. I could be wrong there, but I'm not expecting any miracle myself. Donald Trump to get onto the phone to Zelensky and saying, we're going to have peace negotiations now, we're going to have concessions. And I don't expect either President Trump, if we get a President Trump, to say, yeah, let's go ahead with a war with Iran. I think we need to separate the rhetoric from actually what might happen. Now, I could be wrong there, but that's just my feeling on that one. Okay, moving on very quickly, and I won't take long on it. It's worth commenting on, and that is the crisis that we have in Britain with our water supply. It's not that when I turn on the tap now, no water comes out, but what we have is the company that owns the infrastructure, that owns and is meant to deliver the water to the likes of me, basically declaring itself insolvent. And so what I'm talking about is Britain's biggest water company, Thames Water. It has 16 million customers in the southeast, and it's just announced that it cannot pay £190 million of interest payments to its bankers. Is this an example of greedy capitalists? Well, it's not a story about greedy capitalists in terms of the current owners of Thames Water, but it is a story about greedy capitalists when it comes to the previous owners of Thames Water. And I think it was an Australian company called Macquarie. I think that's their name. And this was a company that bought Thames Water and basically used it to rack up debt, which they then, through a whole manner of different financial channels, used to milk the company in terms of dividend payments. So you end up with a company that has massive debts, and what the present owners, which I think consist of insurance companies, including Chinese concerns, these people were proposing to Ofwat, the government regulator of the water industry, that the 16 million customers of Thames Water should face charges of a 40% increase over 5 years above inflation. And Ofwat has turned around and said, no, we're not going to agree to that. Now, I don't know whether that's Ofwat or whether that's the government in an election year saying this isn't going to go down well amongst an awful lot of consumers in the southeast. But what we're faced with now is almost the certainty of a shareholder haircut and or the prospect of nationalisation. The Financial Times ran an article on the question as it would, and basically said, well, you might get another buyer, but who would want to buy that? So the chances are what we'll have is government administration and nationalisation in either in name or in reality. And I just finish with this, that to me, Thames Water, hand in hand with the railways, symbolizes the utter complete failure of the Thatcherite program of privatization. We were told, I mean, can you seriously credit it? We were told that the denationalization of such industries would allow competition to flourish. Well, it's true. When I switch on my light, I could choose a different supplier, but it's still electricity. In the same way, can you seriously imagine competition with water? This is pseudo competition. It's got nothing to do with competition. This is an opportunity that the Tories supplied basically to capitalists to make a killing. And that's what they've done. And we're now left with the wreckage. And so, in Britain, not only do we have Thames Water effectively going bust, all we need to do is look at the High Speed 2 railway project, which made sense, at least to me, if it was going to be a high speed train all the way up to Edinburgh and Glasgow. That made sense. But now what we have is a high speed train that goes to Birmingham, and we don't even have a central London station agreed. I mean, so okay, it saves someone, what, 20 minutes to Birmingham, at the cost of billions. The project is being cut, 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 cut. Okay. Let me move on. I'll be very brief with this one. We've had the announcement by scientists, and this is a staggering figure. 38.5 degree centigrade increase in the temperature in the Antarctic. I mean, imagine that in a country like Britain. Today, I haven't looked at the temperature, but yesterday it was 20 degrees centigrade. Well, add 38 degrees centigrade on top of that, and human life is impossible. You couldn't simply survive in what would it be? 58.5 degrees centigrade. The human body is not capable of functioning in such temperatures. Of course, what we're dealing with in the Antarctic is extreme cold. So in terms of what life becomes impossible, it's true that what we're dealing with is penguins. So emperor penguins, for example. I understand that the chicks are dying prematurely because their biological life cycle includes them being hatched and reared on solid ice. And the problem is with the shooting up of temperatures is the ice melts early, and the poor things are being landed in the water before they grow waterproof feathers. So they got their fluffy down, which keeps them warm, but they haven't got their sleek, oily feathers. But of course, we're not just dealing with the consequences of global warming for wildlife. We're also dealing with the consequences for humanity. And the obvious first thing to note is if Antarctica is melting, and it is melting, then that will have consequences, first of all, for average sea levels. So we can, just look at the pictures over the last 10 years of the Antarctic ice sheet. And we're talking about ice in the sea, remember here, not on the continent of Antarctica, but as it extends out into the sea. That is shrinking, shrinking, shrinking. And of course, as has been pointed out by the scientists, as it shrinks, what is happening is the amount of heat that is reflected back out into space decreases, and therefore you get into a loop of warming. So there's less white on planet Earth to reflect back heat, less white to reflect back heat, more heating. How will that affect global weather and global climate patterns? Well, interestingly, the scientists say what their models are still not advanced enough to give you an accurate prediction. They can give you a rough and ready prediction, but apparently they haven't got enough data in terms of the Antarctic to give you what they would view as reliable modeling. All we can say, though, is that low-lying cities will be inundated. But also, what we can say is that patterns of climate, patterns of weather will also undergo change. What changes? I'm not in a position to comment on. I haven't read enough, and I certainly don't know enough. But it's an in truly incredible figure. 38.5 degrees, and the scientists themselves are saying that they could hardly believe it. What's the cause of it? Well, unlike very few nowadays, I think it's more or less scientific consensus now that it's human-induced global warming. There's nothing natural about this. We're not dealing with some long-term change. This is the action of humanity, and crucially, the action of the advanced capitalist countries and China now, the workshop of the world. So it's the leading capitalist countries that are responsible, plus China. And of course, meanwhile, what we have in Britain is the Tory government committing to max out on North Sea oil and North Sea gas. And meanwhile, the United States is boosting, boosting, boosting its production of shale oil. Okay. Thought I would comment on Scotland. There's just been new anti-hate legislation passed in Scotland. It's now law. And what we had, I think it was on April the 1st, we had the author J.K. Rowling's tweeting away, or is it Xing away nowadays, attacking various figures. And she ends her diatribe against these people by saying, ha, these people aren't actually women, they're all men. And she finished with, an arrest me then. This is her response to the new law. And of course, that gave Rishi Sunak and the right the opportunity to turn round and say, well, we guard people's freedom of speech and people should have freedom of speech. That's a lie. What we have of anyone who's been on any of the pro-Palestine demonstrations will testify. What we have is wall-to-wall surveillance, both by the police, but also by other means of demonstrators and the picking out of people to prosecute for what I would regard as their freedom to express their opinion. They might want to express their opinions in a different way to me, but I would still say they have the right to do that. So I would say that Ranjit Brar of the Communist Party of Great Britain, Marxist-Leninist, has the right to sell or be associated with a pamphlet that has a swastika and a Star of David, the symbol of the State of Israel, with an equal sign in between it. I wouldn't use that iconography, but hey, looking at what is going on in Gaza at the present time, and looking at what's been going on in Palestine since 1948, I wouldn't call it anything equivalent to the Nazis. Nonetheless, I would certainly draw parallels with the Nazi regime, as I would, for example, with the genocide of the Armenians and other such crimes in the past. Either way, what I wanted to comment on wasn't so much this particular new law. We are having an article in the paper on it. What I wanted to do was actually comment on the disgraceful, absolutely outrageous editorial in the latest edition of Socialist Worker. This is in their What We Think column. So I'm taking this article as particularly authoritative. And it not only says that trans women are women and trans men are men. Okay. You can argue about that and how that's determined. I think that is worthwhile. An argument, for example, we've had recent cases, for example, in Scotland of biological man being sent to an all-women prison, for example. But what I wanted to comment on precisely is their closing line, and that is quoting J.K. Rowling saying, arrest me, and finishing with this: she thoroughly deserves for her wish to be granted. And to me, this is truly stupid. Precisely for the reasons I've already given, that we are under threat ourselves of laws that I think foolishly sections of the left urged upon various governments when it comes to race, sex and all the rest of it, because we are being accused of anti-Semitism. So just a note on all of this, if you take, and it's sort of seared on my brain, if we take the first prosecution under the Race Relations Act, and I think that was Labour legislation, and if I'm not mistaken, I think it was Roy Jenkins who was the Home Secretary at the time, but the first person to be prosecuted was a guy called Michael X, the British version of America's Malcolm X. He was accused of being a racist. Well, maybe he was, but to me, I want to hear what this guy has to say. He wasn't saying go out there and kill people. He wasn't dishing out guns to assassinate people. And that is a very different thing. If J.K. Rowling was saying, here are these people who I'm mocking, who I'm disrespecting, that's true. But if she was advocating going out and killing these people, that clearly would be against the law anyway. And that's a different question, as I've said. Okay, lastly, I just wanted to deal with a couple of documents that I've been given. I can't remember who I was given them by. It could have been our friend Tony Greenstein. I'm not quite sure. Either way, what this is about is a series of five talks, five classes on how to combat anti-Semitism being run by the Communist Party of Great Britain, the Morning Stars Party, in particular, Mary Davis, who was the former editor of its journal, Communist Review. And I've looked at these five courses, and I've looked at the recommended reading and the framing of these courses. And it's clear that what we have with Mary Davis is the CPB's resident Zionist at work. I was quite amazed that if you take her definition, for example, of anti-Semitism, it's derived from the work of Kenneth L. Marcus. I hadn't heard of Kenneth L. Marcus. I had to look him up. He's a Democrat, and he served as Assistant Secretary of Civil Rights under the Obama administration between 2018 and 2020. And he's written a book on the definition of anti-Semitism. And it's true that when it comes to the discussion, for example, of the BDS, the boycott, sanctions, and disinvestment campaign, can't quite make up his mind whether that's actually an example of anti-Semitism or not. Nonetheless, what he is clearly a liberal Zionist. And what he's looking to fight is hostility, not only to Jews of the traditional sort of anti-Semitism. What he's determined to do is fight what is called the new anti-Semitism. And the new anti-Semitism isn't the Nazi sort of anti-Semitism. It isn't the medieval sort of anti-Semitism. It's not the ancient Roman sort of anti-Semitism. This is anti-Semitism that's born of the State of Israel. And this is where, according to its advocates, the enemies of Zionism become the new anti-Semites. And of course, we saw that in Britain. We saw that whole battle fought out in the Labour Party, directed against Jeremy Corbyn. And with Jeremy Corbyn backtracking all the way and sadly letting friend and supporter one after the other, letting them go to the wolves. Jenny Formby, the General Secretary appointed by Jeremy Corbyn when he was leader of the Labour Party, boasting that she was speeding up expulsions, boasting. That she was speeding up investigations. Now, it's true that what we had is a lot of people expelled from the Labour Party, not for anti-Semitism, but for bringing the Labour Party into disrepute. But the initial charges, what sticks is the charges of anti-Semitism. And that included people like Tony Greenstein, or we mentioned Tony Greenstein. Wasn't kicked out for anti-Semitism, he was charged with anti-Semitism. Mark Wadsworth, the black socialist campaigner, he was kicked out for anti-Semitism, for pointing the finger at a Labour MP who was sitting next to a reporter from the Daily Telegraph and attacking her. He was kicked out because this MP happened to be Jewish. He didn't even know she was Jewish. We've had one after the other. Jackie Walker kicked out, not for anti-Semitism, but charged with anti-Semitism. In this online communist forum, I noted Stan Keeble here. He was sacked by a Labour council, charged with anti-Semitism, hauled through employment tribunal after employment tribunal until he was found not guilty. But who cares about that? Kick him out of his job. And we've had case after case after case like that. So thousands of people. This is the campaign against the new anti-Semitism. Well, it's hardly surprising that the victims, and I do mean victims of this witch hunt, a huge proportion turn out to be Jewish. Why? Because Israel claims to act on behalf, claims to be the state of all Jews. And it isn't surprising that some people who are politically ignorant fall for that. That doesn't surprise me. But also people who aren't politically ignorant, who happen to be Jewish, want to militantly disassociate themselves from that. So if you go to any of the great London demonstrations, the national demonstrations in Britain, there's been 11 of them so far. What is noticeable and to me extremely pleasing is the number of Jewish people and Jewish contingents who are marching. I think that this is a great and correct a stand amongst Muslims, for example, who might be misled by Israel's claims to be acting on behalf of all Jews. This will be an education. And I do note when you do have these contingents, including from the ultra-Orthodox Jewish community, of course, they are greeted as the demonstration passes them by. And as they join the demonstration, they are greeted with acclaim. And so, you know, Suella Braverman, our former Home Secretary, called these marches hate marches. Of course, they aren't hate marches. They might hate genocide. They might hate ethnic cleansing. They might hate the killing of women and children and innocent civilians. They might hate branding Hamas a terrorist organization that's bent on the extermination of all Jews. They might hate that, but no, these weren't hate marches. But in that context, that's why I find the course that Mary Davis is running and the CPB is promoting to be amazing, because what we should be educating ourselves on is how to combat this big lie that the left is full of anti-Semites, that society is full of anti-Jewish hatred. And so I looked at not only Kenneth L. Marcus, liberal Democrat, as I said, former Assistant Secretary for Civil Rights in the Obama administration. I looked at her other sources. And lo and behold, I sort of couldn't almost believe it, but we have sources such as, for example, the Community Security Trust. You're meant to read this before you take the fifth course, for example, about modern anti-Semitism. And they have two documents, one about anti-Semitism in the community as a whole. And they also have a document showing the massive increase in anti-Semitism on the campus. I'm sure there has been an increase, by the way, in anti-Semitic incidents in Britain. I can't believe that there hasn't been with what's been going on in, you know, in Palestine, in Gaza, obviously, in particular. I can't believe that there hasn't been an increase. The problem I have, though, is that the Community Security Trust is notorious for precisely interpreting what is anti-Semitism and what hasn't got anything to do with what is anti-Zionism and what hasn't got anything to do with anti-Semitism as anti-Semitism. And so the example I've been using recently is the Defense Secretary's poor daughter, who's at university in Leeds, and how her fellow students in her politics course had the temerity to call Israel an apartheid state. And that was run as a story by the Daily Telegraph, showing the increase in anti-Semitism. Well, Jimmy Carter called Israel, in terms of the West Bank, for example, an apartheid state. Many UN reports have called Israel an apartheid state, not only on the West Bank, but also in Israel proper. This is not anti-Semitism, and that is what the CPB ought to be combating, not joining in on this new anti-Semitism witch hunt, which is being run by the establishment, yes, with the cooperation of organizations such as the Alliance for Workers' Liberty, a social imperialist organization. Just looking at last of her sources, I just looked at, again, my sort of mouth went, what? Jonathan Friedland from The Guardian, the Guardian's resident Zionist. So these people, yes, you know, that she's quoting and she's wanting us to read, no doubt will disapprove of the Netanyahu far right government with the, you know, how should I put it, apocalyptic views that these people have in terms of driving out all Arabs and all the rest of it. Yes, they'll object to that. But she, for example, wants us to answer in the affirmative when you're asked the question of is it anti-Semitic to demand the end of Israel as a Jewish state? She wants us to say that's anti-Semitism. And I say no, that isn't anti-Semitism, that's anti-Zionism. And the problem with Zionism is it's predicated not only on taking over another people's land, it's about dispossessing and driving out those people. And it has to do that precisely because here we have a colonial settler project that cannot rely on millions and millions keeping coming from some home territory, however wide, you know, however defined, as for example, as with the United States, to keep relying on European people moving to the United States in order to dispossess the native population. Okay, so what is the CPB doing promoting Zionism? I find that remarkable because I would define Zionism precisely as an example of blood and soil ideology. And I would define Zionism as a racist project. I'll finish with that, Gabby. Thank you.